The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. These days, we're not shocked to find R. Crumb in the pages of The New Yorker, or to read a book about the Holocaust rendered as a comic strip. It's hard to believe that comic books were once considered dangerous business. In The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America, David Haidu chronicles a little-known piece of American history, what Jeff Boucher and the LA Times called a very serious attack on funny books. Boucher writes, "By 1949, the police department in Cleveland, where Superman's creators lived, had two full-time police officers on the comic book beat. In April of that year, a poor fellow by the name of William Dickey was arrested at his Florence Avenue drugstore in Walnut Park for selling a comic book to a teenager. The title of the comic, fittingly, was Crime Does Not Pay." It is hard to believe, but tonight we will hear this hard-to-believe story, believe it or not. The author of The 10-Cent Plague, David Haidu, is the author of Lush Life, a well-received biography of Billy Strayhorn, and the dazzling 1960s folk scene portrait, Positively 4th Street, The Lives and Times of Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Mimi Baez Farinha, and Richard Farinha, for which I especially thank him deeply. I've always been a Richard Farinha fan. You'll notice his music was playing when you came in. And no wonder David wrote about Farinha. They share the same birthday. Both of his books were named finalists for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Interviewing David tonight is Ben Schwartz, who's written on cartooning for the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, LA Weekly, Comic Art, and he's currently on assignment for Vanity Fair. Ben blogs for the Huffington Post, the New York Times Laugh Line, and his book, The Lost Laugh, A History of American Comedy Set Between the World Wars, is forthcoming from Fantagraphics. Please welcome our speakers tonight, David Haidu and Ben Schwartz. Thank you.
Just to clarify, that's David Haidu, and I'm Ben Schwartz. It came out in the wrong order, maybe.
I'm going? That's it? No questions? Thanks for coming. Nice to have you all here. It's a thrill. There's something I wanted to say at the start, and it's what a treat it is for me to do this event at a library. I don't get to speak in libraries that often, but the library has a special importance to me. I could tell a very, very brief story that would illustrate the importance of the library to me. Sure. You know, it's such a cliche to pull this forward and say, you know, is this on and stuff? So I was just avoiding being that cliche. I'm better at being other cliches. So I grew up in a little smoky Springsteenish factory town in New Jersey called Phillipsburg. It's a steel town, and it was built to provide men who gave their bodies to the service of the making of steel. And most of those men were Italians or other immigrants. I'm half Italian and half Hungarian. And the first generation of immigrants lived in the row houses by the steel mill, which was called, the area was called the Flats. And then the second generation of the sons and daughters of the immigrants moved to the Hill, which represented social ascension. And my parents were of the Hill generation. They had white-collar jobs. And when I grew up, we were not permitted to set foot on the Flats where my mother was raised and where my grandmother lived. It was considered dangerous and vaguely urban, and who knows what went on there. Probably juvenile delinquency and kids reading comic books. But the only place where we were permitted to go on the flats was the public library. It's the only place my mother would say, well, you can go as long as you're going to the library. And we did, because the library represented for us a source of illumination and, of course, and enlightenment, but also a way out of this environment. So much so that my brother and my cousin Dick used to skip school to go to the library. And so the library to me was always this kind of hallowed, sacred place. And I'm not just saying that because I'm in a library. It's not like I have a spiel about wherever I am. But it's a special treat to be here, and that's what I wanted to say.
Well, yeah. I wanted to start out talking about David's book with a little news that just happened a few hours ago, because David's book is about the comic book censorship. What's we call it? Scandal? Well, it's called 10 Cent Plague. And for those of us who are comic book fans, it is a plague. But just a few hours ago, Osama bin Laden released a new message. And what he's upset about now, in his endless list of grievances with us, is, and this is just what the Reuters report says, Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden threatened the European Union with grave punishment on Wednesday over cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. In an audio recording posted on the internet, bin Laden said the cartoons were part of a crusade in which he said Catholic Pope Benedict was involved. I didn't know he was a cartoonist. But just in case you thought comic censorship and the passions that comics and cartoonings can incite or inspire in people was something that happened in the 1950s and only during the Eisenhower era, it's a powerful art form, and over 50 people have died in protests over the cartoons. And I don't mean to make light over just how seriously Muslims take these cartoons and the images of Muhammad, but it is just, it shows you still how powerful this medium that we often take for granted can be.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons for that is that photographs and other photographic images and film have a pretense to depict reality. we think of them as depicting reality. But cartoons clearly represent a point of view, a take on something, an internalization of the world, a processing of the world, and an attitude or a point of view, a thought, a feeling. And that's, I think, the reason that they have the power that they do is that they represent an internalization and a clear point of view, a take. And that's, as a result, they've incited the ire of their targets since the beginning of cartooning. In the 100 years ago, in the early days of newspaper comics, my book starts with a section on the early days of newspaper comics. And newspaper comics were the objects I was going to give a number and say dozens, because the number's not important, but the venom that was spewed at newspaper comics is the point. And it's because what they depicted, it's not only what they depicted, which was a kind of a raucousness, a kind of skepticism toward authority, a court of pride and outsider status, and a pride in being immigrants of all kinds, you know, like strangers in a strange land, but also an enthusiasm for all of that, a love and a passion and a sense of fun. And that's what I think was really kind of rankled people, you know, not just that it's depicting the world of immigrants and, you know, and outsiders and ruffians and but doing so with a sense of kind of, but reveling in the doing.
And without, I think you point out about, say, early strips like the Katzenjammer Kids, without any sense of teaching anybody an important lesson. I think the line you quote is from the captain, their German father, society is nix because of you.
Right.
And it's always the kids who seem to get away with it. You know, they, as you said, they just kind of revel in their their violence and their delinquency.
Right.
What's about them?
Well, the kids in those strips, in the early newspaper strips, serve as stand-ins for the immigrant population. The Katzenjammer kids and the yellow kid and, you know, countless other kids who are who see adults as, you know, ludicrous objects of enforcing dubious values. And what they're really challenging in that portrayal of kids reacting to adults is the all of us as citizens of a culture being having to, you know, follow the dictates of that culture.
Well,
I didn't say that very well. Do you get what I mean? Okay, all right. Well, so if somebody has a better way of saying that, scribble me a note.
Well, let me ask you about that, specifically about the period your book covers, because it's the 1940s and 50s, and today, nobody really thinks of comics like that, except maybe Osama bin Laden. You know, today we have cartoonists like Chris Ware and Dan Clowes and Adrian Tamayo appear in The New Yorker. Their graphic novels are reviewed in The New York Times. They win literary awards. And we have
It's Osama.
We have movies, you know, superhero films, or Harvey Pekar's comics have been turned into movies that win Academy Awards. And how was the 40s and 50s different for that, with the way people perceive comics from the way they do today? Because today, you can check them out of the library today.
Well, that took a long time. There are very few art forms that start out as a form for kids that eventually gain credibility and legitimacy in the larger establishment. Very few. We don't take board games seriously as an art form. You know, there are no Etch-a-Sketch drawings in the Museum of Modern Art. You know, there are very few. Once an art form has an association with kids, it's frozen in the public's mind as being juvenile, as being juvenilia. There are very few exceptions. Comics are the most vivid exception. Not just years, but decades, comics were considered disreputable because they were. They were. And that was their nature. That was their purpose, and that was their value. The people who created comics were mostly young people meaning kids in their teens or in their early 20s, were creating, making up a form of art that they saw as a challenge to all the niceties of more conventional modes of expression. And it was the comics were designed as a challenge to the status quo. They were designed to be unorthodox. They were designed to be disreputable. And they succeeded. Then young people embraced them for that reason, because they were disreputable, and they represented a challenge to their parents and to the society that their parents represented. Now, it's taken some time for comics to achieve respectability. What's happened? How has that occurred? Well, one thing has happened: time is the friend of all disreputable arts. It was the friend of jazz. It took time for us to understand the merits of jazz. We were talking earlier about Louis Armstrong, and Louis Armstrong's music at one time was ridiculed. The early jazz was ridiculed as being just dance music, music meaning just music for the body, not for the mind. All beat, it was primitive. There was a kind of racism in the criticism of early jazz. It's just it's vulgar and it's primitive. And comics, now we see the art in jazz, and it's just taken time for us to see the art in comics. What else has happened? What do you think?
Well, at that time...
Give me some time. Buy me some time. What do you think?
Well, I think that, the people who grew up on those comics and still collect those comics that came out then... I always thought that one thing that impressed people that made comics credible is when they would read that a Superman number one is worth, I don't know, $50,000, $100,000. And once you can attach $100,000 to a comic book, people say, well, it must be serious. It must be, but they have been with us for 100 years. And people are, I think, well aware of New Yorker cartoonists like James Thurber or people like Gary Trudeau and Charles Schulz. But I think it's the generations that grew up with it that now are in positions to write books and edit newspapers and magazines. Mm-hmm. And then people like, I think a generation of cartoonists that wanted to be taken seriously as artists, as cartoonists. They didn't look at it as, people like Art Spiegelman or Robert Crumb. So I think that helped a lot. Mm-hmm. And that we now live in a culture where almost any kind of creative endeavor, it can be a web page, it can be a song downloaded on the internet, we're a culture that's willing to take our own culture more seriously now. Mm-hmm. Jazz and comics, movies, those are American inventions. Mm-hmm. I think we take ourselves more seriously now. So I think that's one thing.
One of the things that surprised me when I was researching this book and I was looking back at the comics of the 30s and 40s, but with a special focus on the comics of the late 40s and the early 50s, was how great so many of them are. I was surprised myself to see how strong the writing was, how inventive the writing was, how daring the writing was, and how explicitly the writing challenged the status quo. Particularly in romance comics, I never expected to find much depth in romance comics. I was stunned to find how explicitly romance comics and challenge the prevailing notions of what a young girl should be. You know, they were kind of proto-feminist, and I was surprised to look back and at. I mean, we know that Kurtzman was a genius. We know Eisner was a genius. We know the handful of the great men of comics. But I was surprised to find that there were dozens of very, very good artists working in comics. And one thing that struck me was that the source of the quality and the power of these comics was that the artists clearly were not seeking legitimacy. They didn't care whether someone like me read it then or later and said, oh boy, this is great. They were clearly done for the best possible purpose, which was for the sake of expressing something, however kind of arcane or unorthodox it was, that person felt that he or she needed to express. These comics have that veracity. I mean, they're not seeking legitimacy, and I think that's a big source of their power.
Well, and there's such a wildness to them. I mean, the crime comics. I grew up on comics. I think a lot of us in the room did today. I don't remember pre-code comics. I always grew up on. And we'll get into what the comics code is. But I grew up on pretty much censored, government-approved comics. So they were superhero comics and Archie comics. But what was one of the crime stories you talk about is the
Wild Spree of the Laughing Sadist.
Yeah. Which was sold to kids.
Yeah.
It's funny. You know, we were talking about kids before we came out. I have an 18-month-old now, and I think, well, of course I'd censor that comic. I'm a parent now. I've been a parent for a year and a half. I know what people should read and what they shouldn't. But
when my kids were 18 months, they knew a lot about sadism.
Yeah, especially towards their parents.
I wanted to just add another thought to the point I was making before about doing the work for the best possible purposes. And I'm reminded, you no doubt know this quote from Chuck Jones when he was asked about the Warner Brothers, the Looney Tunes cartoons. He was asked at one point, did you make them for kids or for adults? And he said, neither. We made them for ourselves. You know? And comic books until recently, because they were not legitimate, gave the artists a kind of freedom and liberty. There was no censoring body like the FCC watching over the comics. There was no body like the Hays Office imposing regulations or code on comics for a long time, and so they could be freewheeling and experimental and kooky and wild and make mistakes. But then also that freedom allowed comics to go too far. As they often did, yeah. As they sometimes did, and we end up with things like the wild spree of the laughing sadist, which makes us giggle now, but that was extreme in those days, and it's utterly comparable to Hostel 2 or The Hills Have Eyes 17 or whatever number we're up to today. I mean that work was extreme. It was unprecedented in its graphicness and not just in its daring, but in the discomforting portrayal of violence as play. It's a very complicated subject. There were other comics published by a fellow named Stanley Morse, who's still alive, by the way, and I interviewed him for this book, and he published the most gruesome, horrible comics. And when you look at that work, and you see like the sadomasochism rampant in that work, and the vulgarity and the violence, you really start to understand how the parents, the kids reading them, the larger culture of adults who were protecting the society in those days felt that something had to be done, and you can understand how a war ensued. And there really was a culture war over comics and a hysteria. The country basically went crazy over comics.
And there were massive book burnings of comics. I think at one burning you talk about in the book, over 30,000 comics mm-hmm. were burned, and no wonder they're so valuable today. It's just there can't be any left.
Yeah.
But 30,000, I mean, I can't imagine 30,000 of anything being burned or destroyed like that. Just in one little area, you know, it's one. I forget which town it was, but this happened all over. It happened
all over the country. All over the country, and not just in rural areas, but in suburban areas as well. And not that long after World War II, the first comic book burnings took place in 1945. That's months after the war. And there was not just one or two isolated event where some crazy extremists decided, oh, let's burn some comics. They were rampant. They were rampant. And kids were lured into schoolyards, and they were encouraged to travel around neighborhoods and collect their comics and build these ablational bonfires and set them aflames. These events were highly ritualized. And sometimes the kids were given incantations to recite and pledges to disavow comics, and they pledged to never read comics, and very, very frightening. And the kids who were doing this, it's easy to think of the kids who were doing this as, you know, the objects of puppet mastery of extreme adults. But tracked down a couple dozen of the people who were kids then and who took part in these events. And they weren't interviewed at the time, because very few comic book fans were interviewed during the time of this hysteria. Just newspaper reporters and other people who were writing about it at the time just didn't bother to interview the kids. They didn't think of, and it's one of the issues here, is that they didn't think of the kids' point of view as legitimate. And that's one of the reasons that the war was ensuing, this battle was ensuing, because kids were laying claim to the legitimacy of their point of view, of their taste. That's one of the key issues. But I asked these kids, I went down to West Virginia, and I found the kid who led a burning down there, and there was another one in Binghamton, New York, and I found a number of the kids who did them, and I asked them, you know, what were you doing? And they said, well, we were torn. We were torn, and the whole country was torn at this point. And it was a cusp of like one sensibility, the end of one sensibility, the emergence of another sensibility, one set of social values and aesthetic values in decline, and the emergence of another one. And there was this tension like this. But one of these kids told me a story about it shows how the kids were ambivalent, but so were some of the parents. They told me this story about collecting the comics for the bonfire and surreptitiously taking some of them, you know, was going around the neighborhood, I'm here to collect all the comics, but there was a genre called jungle comics, if you're familiar with them, which specialized in portrayals of jungle girls. We all know how common, voluptuous, blonde white women are in the jungle, of course.
In bikinis.
In leopard skin bikinis. Yeah. You know, we all know from anthropology from how common that is. So this guy, this
we're
young
sophisticated
boy.
Sophisticated people, we know.
So this young boy took the jungle comics, jungle girl comics, set them aside and kind of took them home and to hide them. So he went up into the living room and lifted up the cushion in the sofa and found his father's detective magazines there. So he had to find another hiding place.
Well, and you brought up a point that I found really interesting in the book, which is that nobody took the comic book readers seriously. And it made me think of 1950s free speech battles. We all know, like Allen Ginsberg's Howl, Nabokov's Lolita, Lenny Bruce, you know, his skirmishes with the censors of the day, and the Blacklist here in Los Angeles, we all know about for political censorship. And, you know, you've always had an argument then. You always had someone like Nat Hentoff, or you had the people at the New Yorker or the New York Times talking about the First Amendment, or Norman Mailer or signing petitions, and Saul Bellow and such, and the intellectuals of the day and the cultural arbiters of the day. Nobody helped comic books. Nobody cared.
Well, that's because they were kids' stuff, and because the young people had no advocates. And one of the key issues was the right of young people to have their own taste. Now, this whole battle of comics came to a climax in a set of dramatic Senate hearings. I don't want to reveal too much of this because the price of curiosity is $24.50. Is that the price? But there's a set of Senate hearings that climax with the publisher of EC Comics and also Mad Magazine, Bill Gaines, giving some testimony that proved devastating to the comics industry and also devastating to Gaines at the time. He ended up having to shut down his operation and discontinued all the comics that he was most proud of. But in the course of this testimony, the testimony boiled down to a discussion of a cover of a crime suspense story comic that showed an image of a killer who had decapitated a victim. And the killer was holding the head of his victim by the hair, and blood is dripping from the neck. And at the Senate hearings, he's asked by Senators Hendrickson and Estes Kefauver how he could defend this. And Estes Kefauver said, do you consider that? Oh, what grounds can you possibly defend this? And this is not verbatim, but it's pretty close. And he said, well, we're only concerned with taste. Our primary concern is taste. Kefauver said, taste? Do you consider that in good taste? He said, yes, for a crime comic. And that was it. Now, the next day, the front page of the New York Times focused on that moment in the testimony. Time Magazine also. And when we think about what that meant, it boils down to not just the issue of taste, but the right of one person to have other tastes than someone else. The notion that tastes are subjective and they cannot be dictated by the culture at large or by any cultural institution, especially governmental institutions, or by any generation. And the notion that young people have the right to taste of their own was radical and unacceptable in those days.
Yeah. And the impact of those Senate hearings was, as out here in the movie business, the blacklist. One of the things that was most striking about your book is that in the back of the book, you listed 800 names of artists, writers, and editors who never worked again. Mm-hmm. 800. I mean, we, you know, the blacklist
is terrible. Well, now nobody's going to buy the book, for goodness sake.
Well, I'm not going to say any of the names.
Okay.
The, I won't read them.
No, the book is a war story in many ways, and it's all we talked about, this battle. The book is a story of... The word plague has two meanings. And in one sense, the obvious meaning is that to the anti-comics crusaders, the comics were a plague, that they were perceived as a contagion, this insidious force that was corrupting young people and had threatened to corrupt the whole culture. So the comics were a plague. By the same token, once that culture clamped down on comics and enacted the near death of the comics industry and ruined the lives of a great many people, just as the Red Scare did, just as the McCarthy hearings did, and just as the HUAC hearings did here in Hollywood, the artists who were victims of that clampdown considered that set of actions a plague. They said it was like the plague. You couldn't say you were a comic book artist. You couldn't work after this. Now, many people did return to comics years later. There were people who worked in the 40s and 50s who didn't work for a while and then recovered in the 60s and 70s. But there's a certain number who felt so wounded that this art form that they treasured so and respected so and they were so devoted to was so maligned by the culture, and that their livelihood was taken from them. They felt so wounded that they never recovered and were never published again. I said the number is 800. And there's a list in the end, at the end of the, I mean, we all know, we could think about the people who were blacklisted, who, you know, Dalton Trumbo and the Hollywood 10 and Ring Lardner and the number, oh my God, we all know about how deeply that affected those lives. This is 800 people. I asked a great many of them about those events today, and they're still wounded. They were still wounded 50, 60 years later.
I think you opened the book with a really compelling interview with Janice Valou, who did romance comics.
Yeah.
That was another thing about the romance comics, that so many of them were done by women. Mm-hmm. And then their jobs just disappeared too.
Oh, a lot more comics were drawn by women than people realize. There were dozens and dozens of very fine artists who were women. They drew not only romance comics, but a lot of the Jungle Comics. And of Janice Valou's specialty was Tony Gale, who was a crime-solving fashion model / aviatrix. That old genre. So it must have been fun to just get to make up whatever you wanted and have it published.
When you describe it that way, it sounds like Charlie's Angels 1940s style. I guess. Well, and this book, too, you talked about it as it's sort of about a cultural war, but I want to ask you about your other books in a way, because your first book was a biography of Billy Strayhorn. Mm-hmm. Your second book is about the 1960s folk scene in New York City. Mm-hmm. And then this book expands into a full-blown history. So I was just wondering, as you as a writer, was that a progression you noticed yourself, or is it just something about you just kind of went with each of these subjects that were interesting to you?
Well, I try not to think of... I think there's a danger for a writer in thinking of his or her work as his or her work. And I think that can be a trap. Or you could make a nice little prison for yourself if you think of yourself that way. And it also could engender sense of self-importance. I try to avoid that. So I follow my passions and enthusiasms, and because I'm trained as a journalist... But I'm doing history. I want to tell untold stories. So it's important for me for a story to be one that I think has either been told or not fully told, or to have a new point of view in a story. So that I can render that story fresh in some way. What do they have in common? I only realize what, I only see what they have in common now from a distance. And I didn't intend to make a triptych or something. But I see now that the first book was, well, I knew at the beginning when I was making the first book that it was a study of the popular music of the first half of the 20th century, of jazz, through the lives of a pair of creative collaborators, through Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn. And once I had done that, my appreciation for the collaboration in the creative realm had become acute. And when I did my second book, I wanted to do something about the popular music of the second half of the 20th century, the rock era. And I did that through like Ellington is a towering figure, and Strayhorn a lesser known figure. I wanted to deal with the towering figures of the music of the second half of the 20th century through its, where was I syntactically? Popular music, 20th century, towering figures, Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. I mean, let's not forget how important Joan was before Bob. She, as a cultural force, she was enormously significant first. Bob came up riding her coattails. And then I wanted to explore their world through two lesser-known people, less important people, because through doing that, if I had four people all setting out to change the world, two do, two don't, it's a study in the nature of success in this culture. So those were the goals of those books. But what happened in the course of writing Positively 4th Street was, in the course of making a deep study of the popular culture of the post-war era, and also through my music criticism, because I'm a working critic, did the music criticism for the New Republic. I kept finding myself repeating the origin story of rock and roll, which we think of as being the same as the origin story of post-war popular culture. You know, post-war popular culture, it's steeped in cynicism and cynicism toward authority and kind of a bad boy, bad girl, you know, ethos, and it's kind of a raucousness and an earthiness. And so we think of all that starting with rock and roll and Elvis and or Chuck Berry and Little Richard. And okay, but you know, the more I studied that, the more seriously I studied that, the more I went back to the primary materials, I realized, well, wait a minute. There was this other thing that happened first. And it made me realize that the origins of post-war popular culture really go back, not, yes, to rock and roll, but, and I don't buy into some single source theory. I don't think it's only rock and roll. I don't think it's only comics. But before rock and roll, there were comics, and comics had a deep, deep impact on popular culture. And what they represented was what we associate with rock and roll. And comics were first. So as much as the book is a thesis book, the thesis is a repositioning of the birth of post-war popular culture. But it's not elementally a thesis book. It's elementally a kind of a landscape or narrative book. It's elementally a story. It's a story of the people who made comics and what happened and how the culture went crazy and the tragic consequences of that craziness.
Well, and it definitely fits in, as you said, the story you don't know as well, you know, because I knew a little bit about the Senate hearings and how EC Comics at the peak of it were the problem, but everything that leads up to it, the hysteria, the burnings, the number of people affected, and you brought along a short film that's a great example of the hysteria. It was actually produced here in Los Angeles for local television. What was it called?
It's called Confidential Files. There was a prototype of the TV news show called Confidential Files. It was a half an hour news magazine program produced here in LA, hosted by Paul Coates, who was an LA Times columnist, written by A.J. Fennedy, who's still alive and living here in LA. And the show sought to to expose horrible things happening in the world, like child prostitution and use of illicit drugs, the reading of comic books. And in 1955, one of the episodes was about the demon comic books, and we could show a clip of it. And what you're going to see is Paul Coates on stage, and then I'm going to set this up so you understand what you're seeing. Then you're going to, Paul Coates he doesn't really introduce it. What we see after his introduction is what seems like documentary footage, but we all will recognize it as trumped up fake documentary footage. We'll see that. And it was shot by Irvin Kershner, who...
He's still directing today? He directed Empire...
He's gone, but he did The Empire Strikes Back.
And he did what was the big crime film he did in the...
Pick Up on South Street?
Dope Street.
Pick Up on Dope?
No. It was Stakeout on Dope Street.
Stakeout on Dope Street.
A crime favorite, a cult classic of favorite of people like James Ellroy. And, mm-hmm. But yeah, it's...
Now remember, we're going to see this and we're going to think, oh, it's Reefer Madness of comics. But, I mean, try not to see it through the lens of the present and try to imagine what this was like in 1955. But we're ready if you could roll this.
Crime worshipping violence of certain comic books has come in for a lot of scathing criticism during the past couple of years. Resolutions have been introduced, experts have written books, governmental committees have held hearings. Even in the comic industry itself, steps have been taken to clean up some of the filth. The Comics Magazine Association of America, Incorporated, has been formed and a code written. Here's a copy of it. Code sounds fine. Appointed a czar to enforce it. But the undesirable comic books haven't disappeared from the newsstands of this country. Why? I'll tell you exactly why. Because no action has been taken by the most powerful influence in America, the people, you. Many of the publishers are already out of business, but there's an immense backlog still in the warehouses and on the newsstands. Unless the individual communities find out where they are and get rid of them, these books will be around for years. There are about 60 million, that's 60 million, comic books published every month in the United States. But those figures are really quite misleading, and in a minute you'll see why. Ask 10 kids where they got the comic book they're reading. Maybe one or two will tell you they bought it. The rest trade it for theirs. They buy one book and they read 10. It's wonderful economics, but unfortunately it means that 10 times as many kids read books they never should even see. There are no economic or racial lines to the comic book threat. They reach every strata. Kids read them in the north and in the south. Stories like The Human Hyena. Stories like Time to Die. They read them in living rooms in Dubuque and alleys in Manhattan. They read them in tree houses. They leave them tucked into their notebooks in classrooms. And at night they dream about them. One glance is enough to tell you that this boy just got out of school for the day. And why shouldn't he be happy? Until supper time he can do anything he wants to do. He's free. And he knows exactly how he'll while away the hours. He'll spend a nice quiet afternoon with a comic book. I think it's important to note here that the comic book wasn't just an anti-boredom measure. He could have played baseball, but he chose the comic book instead. This is the hideout, the secret place where the gang, and I mean gang in a good sense, a group of pals, hangs out after school. It's part of growing up. It's the environment in which you learn to cooperate with your peers without interference from authority. problems come up and you have to handle them yourselves. When I was a boy and played with the gang, we did a lot of things. We roasted potatoes, went on expeditions, we tipped over garbage cans now and then, we wrote nasty remarks about the teacher on the sidewalk. But we never spent an afternoon sitting around like this, reading. Reading something worthwhile. Something that would stimulate their desires to build and to grow. But they're not reading anything constructive. They're reading stories devoted to adultery, to sexual perversion, to horror, to the most despicable of crimes. A corpse that came to death. One of the wonderfully appealing things about children is that they haven't yet come to the age where reality and unreality are divorced. The emotional impact of something they read in a comic book may be much the same as a real-life situation they witness. This one's a poem. I think you should hear it. The draining rain sprays the pane tenderly. The whistling wind winds round the weeds tenderly. And I come to you with arms out wide and one thought inside of me. So I take your lips, I take your heart, tenderly. Maybe you can accept this fact, maybe not. But it is a fact, and I'll prove it to you later in the program. Horror and crime comics upset kids. I'm not talking about any subtle distortion of their emotional makeup. I think that occurs too. But there's a more noticeable, immediate effect. You can see the tension develop as the story gets more gruesome. And if it's a bad one, the kid has a massive jangled nerves by the time he's through it. Feel like to almost knock someone's brains out. This story is about a man who dissolves his own brother in a bathtub full of acid. 10 cents if you name a newsstand. But it looks like I was wrong. They're not going to read all afternoon after all. They've got a great idea for a game. Everybody can play. In this kind of a game, the more the merrier. Even the little guys are invited. My gang used to huddle too. We tried to figure out how we could build a raft to use on the river, or how to earn money for a wiener roast, or how to talk the grocer into buying uniforms for a baseball team. We usually figured it out too. Kids aren't always too realistic, but they're mighty ingenious, as you're about to see. They'll need a little special equipment for the game they're going to play. And they need one more man, preferably a small man. They promise him he'll be the star of the game, and they're telling the truth. They're also telling the truth when they say it's the most exciting game he's ever played. And this is the beginning of a game of violence. They didn't think it up all by themselves, of course. They had an excellent manual, a regular do-it-yourself pamphlet, a crime and horror comic. And they learned their lesson well. I'm not suggesting that comic books instill violence in the minds of these boys. I've never heard any responsible person suggest that. What I am suggesting is that crime and horror comic books stimulate outbursts of destructive violence that might otherwise have been channeled into much less antisocial activity. And remember, these are not the faces of an isolated group of kids. These are not delinquents, not criminals. These are the faces of my sons. These boys are playing, and yet they're not playing. Games like this have ended in death many times. Usually, of course, there's no apparent damage. But I think there is damage, deep, serious damage. Why a repertoire of torture techniques? Why not? They've spent literally hundreds of hours studying the texts. This, for instance, is an ancient Chinese novel, as any confirmed comic book fan can tell you. Men are getting rich off the comic books that teach kids this kind of activity. I don't know how you like it, but it makes me kind of sick.
We should cut it there.
Oh, those are the Senate hearings. Put this.
Okay. One of Irvin Kershner's best. I think. Let me.
I hope there aren't any comic book readers in this room. I don't want
to. Well, we have time for one or two questions before we open it up, and you can ask David some questions. I wanted to ask you, first of all, it's your own background with comics. We emailed, and you said. You actually used to clip and collect Dick Tracy comics.
Oh, that's when I was little. Yeah.
Have they been kind of a lifelong passion for you?
Yeah, no, I don't want to admit how much of a geek I am, but I'm pretty much of a geek. I'm a big geek. So no, I used to clip out. It's really embarrassing. I would clip out the Dick Tracy strips out of the paper and make my own comic books out of the daily strip. It's really kind of geeky. But I always drew, and then when I was in high school, I drew my own comic strip.
Okay.
And The Endless Odyssey of Skip Tumaloo was the name of it. And I still have some copies of it. It's not that atrocious. And the very first work that I ever had published professionally was illustrations, mm-hmm. in the kind of a cartoonish vein for my local newspaper, for the Easton Express. So I've always loved comics. Was a practitioner on an amateur level, and then on a bit on a professional level. And it came in handy when I was doing the interviews for the book, because I wanted to not rely on the secondary materials or previous interviews. I wanted, because I'm trained as a journalist, I'd like to do I will only do work where I can find the witnesses of the events and interview the witnesses of the events. And it came in handy when I was interviewing comic artists to be able to do it myself. At one point, I was interviewing Jack Davis down at his studio in Georgia, and during the interview, Jack was kind of nervously drawing, during the interview, and I said, I was too. We were both drawing. And I said after a while, Jack, what are you drawing there? I'm just curious. And he said, well, I drew you. And I now have this in my office. It's a Jack Davis caricature of me. And I said, well, that's funny because I drew you. So he has my drawing. I don't think he has mine framed, but I have his.
Well, let me ask you one last question. And this, I kind of made a joke of it earlier, but when you look at these comics, we got to look at some of just how violent these comics were. Do you think they should have been sold to kids? I mean, in today's world, we have movie ratings and we have parents can block shows on TV. But these were available to kids and they were marketed specifically for kids.
Well, I'm kind of a First Amendment purist, so I would say yes to the answer. Should they have been sold? That said, I wish that they hadn't been bought. And it's a fine line, and I'm not trying to have it both ways. But I do think that parents do have an acute responsibility to be aware of the content of what kids are consuming. I have a 4.5-year-old myself, and I really, he's not ready to play Grand Theft Auto. And when I'm going to be very concerned about him going with his friends to theaters that have the hostile movies playing in them too. And it's not, I think that like every war except maybe world, not like every war, but like a great many wars, each side thought they were fighting for some thing worth fighting for. And in this case, what makes the story so dramatic and compelling, and I think enduring and worth our attention today, is that there's something to both sides.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about the book, and I want to turn it over to all of you, is that these are, they may be 50 years old, but they are what we would call extreme,
right?
And with no apologies.
I mean, it's a story. It's a story from 50 years ago, but it's very much a story of how of the world today.
Yeah.
You know, I want to say before we open up the floor to questions, if anyone has any questions about my other two books, they should feel free to ask them too. So,
anybody? This man right here.
Did you see the famous Jack Davis little story that Bill Gaines put in where he claimed that the Communist Daily Worker was the biggest critic of comics?
Yeah. Oh, of course.
And it was about
are you a commie dupe?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
I just want to add a little something about psychological effect of comics. I was about 7 in 51, and stories about vampires and werewolves and zombies didn't faze me. But I had one comic that had a story about a devil doll, which was a doll that came to life and killed people. And I was so that frightened me, and I couldn't keep it in my room. I had to put it in. We had a bookcase in the hall, and I had to put it in the hall bookcase.
You see, now you know how the parents felt, because the reason that. One of the reasons why the horror of the comics cut so deep to parents is it cut into parents' fear that what they treasured most, their children, would turn against them. And this is the same fear that you had with your of toys turning against. Children can have the same fear of what they treasure most, their toys turning against them.
I'm just curious. Is there anybody here tonight who actually was a kid then and was buying these comics on the street? You just want to raise hands? Were you? Yeah.
Reading.
Okay, trading.
Right.
Okay. Is there a question up here? This lady back up here? Yeah.
It seems like this is a little late for the League of Decency, but I'm wondering if there's still some residual connection to the League of Decency. Not that League of Decency.
Oh, no, it's not too, not late at all. You're talking about the Catholic League of Decency.
I am.
Yeah. No, the church was the first major institution to clamp down on comics, and the first comic book burnings took place in parochial schools and Catholic schools. The comics were kind of an adaptable demon. Various institutions and groups saw them as a threat for different reasons over the years. The Catholic Church was early to condemn comics for, mostly in those days, superhero comics for glorifying the superhuman and people who were endowed with superhuman powers, which was considered a kind of idolatry.
That
and then,
ties
yeah,
into the follow-up question.
Yeah, the Catholic, and then later, the beginning of World War II, comics were considered fascist. After World War II, they're considered communist. So whatever people had, groups had problem with, you know, comics were the problem.
So, when were the first superhero comics? Is it true that they were all written by Jewish teenagers in New York? And
well, mostly 38, and you want to take this?
Oh, I was just saying, Cleveland, Superman was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Well, I believe they were still in high school in Cleveland. But then Bob Kane's Batman came along pretty quickly. And
he was from the Bronx, the three of them were all Jewish. And
did anyone ever draw a connection to Hercules, which would make complete sense from the point of view of the League of Decency saying this is idolatrous and superhumans ought not to be encouraged? Like, that's unchristian to worship Hercules?
Absolutely. There are dozens of articles in Catholic papers condemning the comics, and they make explicit links to the Greek gods and to pagan deities, and Hercules is explicitly mentioned in at least a couple. There were two articles I could think of written by a Jesuit priest named Robert E. Southard, connected Hercules and Superman as being kind of supernatural and representing idolatry. And Southard's solution was to, it's a really interesting solution, was to create a line of comic books about the Bible that he then marketed. Who's next?
This man here.
Could you talk just a little bit about the Comics Code Authority, which, as I've always understood, was one of the major results of those Senate hearings and had the same ostensible purpose as the production code in the motion picture industry, in that the industry said, no, 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 government don't censor us, we will censor ourselves. And by the time I started buying comic books in the early 60s, that little seal of approval was on the front cover of every comic. But my real question is, were there teeth behind that? Was there an enforcement review mechanism the way there was with the movie industry?
It's a good question. Absolutely. The history of censorship in American popular culture is largely a history of self-regulation as a means to avoid official methods of regulation. And the movie industry, the model for the comics industry was the movie industry, which regulated itself as a way to avoid regulation by the government. And the model for the Comics Code was the Hays Office Code, down to much of the language. And the effect was utterly devastating. Now, there in several ways. Now, on the I can give you a couple examples of surface examples that are minor, and they don't represent what was really insidious about the effect. There could be the female body now could not be represented graphically. Okay, so and if a woman were depicted in three-quarter view and both of her breasts were shown, this was a specific example. The little curve here that indicated this breast had to be deleted, so there was only like a line here. So as if a woman only had one breast. The jungle girls had to stop wearing leopard bikinis and start wearing jungle skirts. The jungle skirts had to defy the laws of physics and could no longer react to, could sweep up with the swing as the girls swung on the vines and had to stay clung to them. Okay, even Betty and Veronica's breasts were reduced. Okay, that was not what was most insidious about the code, and that's not what most artists and writers objected to, and what most artists and writers. What hurt most artists and writers. There was specific language about, I could dig this up in the text, but there could be no challenge of authority in the comics. And that's the thing that kind of tore a hole in the hearts of the comic book writers. And several of the writers and artists said to me, you know what it was this thing about authority. That everybody just had to be squeaky clean. Everybody had to be good. So there was no conflict, there was no drama, the comics couldn't be a release valve, and they could no longer serve as a challenge, the kind of challenge that they always were. Also, there was specific language about honoring the sanctity of marriage and the sanctity of the home. And that alone put the whole romance genre out of business.
I believe there's a lady right here.
I'm wondering how Casper the Friendly Ghost fits into this.
Because he was supernatural.
The mid 50s, and then there was Wendy the Good Witch, and I think he had a couple of other companions. And then there was Little Dot. I don't know if she was part of Sluggo and Nancy, or Little Dot was Little Dot. But what's that? How did they fit in? Were they to manage the code, or were
Dell Comics published Little Dot, Casper, and also Harvey Comics.
Harvey, yeah.
Who's the little devil character?
Little Hot Stuff.
Hot Stuff. He's a devil. He's Satan. But because he was cute, he was still published. They were the victors in this. These kind of benign, sweet, utterly juvenile comics were the victors. And that's one of the tragedies of the story.
Do you have a question here?
Yeah. Thank you. I have a couple of questions. One is to look at the period of time in America's history after the World War II that these comics were actually printed. Do you, one, think that the amount of violence that was depicted in these comic books was a reflection of the age that they were in at the time? Secondly, without wishing to offend or upset anyone religious-wise, do you think that possibly the religions at the time were used as tools by industry and government to control the minds of the young people to not rebel? And thirdly, do you think that comic books transcended illiteracy at that period of time in America?
Yes, yes, yes. Miss? There were yes and no questions. Yes, yes, yes. Miss? Oh, you need a mic.
It's my understanding that comic books were primary reading material for armed forces during, or arms servicemen during World War II, and I'm just wondering how that was reconciled during this comic crackdown in the post-war era.
The army made a list of comics that were acceptable to be sold to GIs or to member of the armed services during World War II. And it was like the Legion of Decency list. It was a list of what was acceptable and implied, but what wasn't on the list, what was condemned. And the early crime comics and were prohibited from being distributed to GIs. Now, what was this important part of your question is really what was the function of GI readership on the evolution of the comic book? And it was profound because GIs got comic books by the truckload. They read them. They had more access to comics than they had to any other form of entertainment during the war. And as a result, comics were reaching readers older than adolescents. So the age of the comic book reader was growing along with the life. As the comics became an older medium, the readership was aging as well. So that when the GIs returned from the war in the late 1940s, they had this passion and enthusiasm for comics and they continued to read. So now men in their late teens, early 20s, up to like the mid 20s, were still reading comics, and the comics aged with them, so that the comics that were made in the 1952 and the early 1950s were very sophisticated and not just kid stuff, because a great many of the readers were young adults. By 1952, the statistic that Paul Coates gave in that film clip was incorrect. There were more than 60 million comics sold every week. There were 80 to 100 million, and they were passed around to another 8 to 10 people. Okay, now, there weren't enough kids to buy 80 to 100 million comics every week, and there weren't enough young bodies to warrant passing around to 6 or 8 more people. Everybody was reading comics, I mean, up to a certain age, and that age was mid-20s. They weren't just an object of fascination for collectors. They weren't just a phenomenon of fandom. They were reaching fans, yes, but they were reaching dullards and intellectuals and outcasts and debutantes and athletes and anybody who was a human being and some others.
It reminds me of something I read in Nick Tosh's biography of Dean Martin, that when Martin and Lewis were together, Dean Martin was a big comic book fan, but he was embarrassed to buy them, so he'd send Jerry to get them. I just thought it was kind of funny. One more question?
That's okay. A heck of a way to end. You should end with a laugh.
Oh, okay. We have two questions down here, so I guess we'll do these.
Yeah, two more. They have to be funny questions.
There's increasing evidence of the comic book format in children's literature today. And they're not just comic books, but they're graphic novels. Do you have a reaction to this?
That's more of a question for Ben. Ben?
Well, there's a new line of books out that they are using comic books now to tell biographies of famous Americans. I think, was it the first one? Was it Jackie Robinson or was it Satchel Paige? I can't remember.
It's Satchel Paige.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so, yeah, they are being used to educate kids and tell them stories like that, which I think is great. You know, the first thing I do remember reading is I had a gold key Walt Disney Digest. And I didn't read, I couldn't read the words, but I remember reading a Carl Barks Donald Duck story over and over. And I still have it, and I look at it, and the story doesn't, it's called Trick or Treat. It's a famous, if you know comics, it's a famous Carl Barks story. But it got me thinking in terms of stories and the beginning, middle, and end, because that's the way his visual sequences work. So I think it's great. And I think it's great that they're aiming comics at kids again, instead of where most comics I actually rate, superheroes, they're really aimed at teenagers and kids in their early 20s or those adults who still want to read the Fantastic Four in their 40s. But they're not really aimed at little kids. They don't, and I think it's great. Only Disney, I think, and Nickelodeon have comics, and that's not a lot, really. So I think it's good. And we have one final question, I guess, this lady.
Mine is several parts, but most of them are short. Okay. How much of the audience for comic books during this time were women? Where did you find your comics that you were reading, that it sounds like you read? And third, if I understand the chronology you're talking about correctly, it sounds as though the code for comic books was created and getting stronger at the time that the code for movies was getting weaker. In 1951, you had the Supreme Court decision that said that movies were protected by the First Amendment, and in 1954, you had Breen leaving the office.
Right, well, that's true. Third question, yes. First two, how many women? Now, there were regular surveys of comic book readership in library journals, so I was able to actually get pretty good data on who was reading comics, the gender and age breakdown through the library journals. Many more women than you'd think. I was, simply put, about 51% of the readership of comics were read, because it mirrored the population as a whole. And I'm not kidding, everybody read comics. It really is that simple in the late 1940s and 1950s. Where did I get the comics that I studied? I was very fortunate to have some collectors let me see their reading copies of their comics. Collectors kind of keep the comics as sacred objects. A lot of comics are now available online, and there are significant holdings of comics in a few institutions. There's a comics research library at the Ohio State University, which is a great help to me. There's a comics research library in Buffalo also. So it's a combination of collectors, online sources, and a couple of institutions. That's not exactly a roaring funny answer. Do you have
It's interesting that today it's another audience that, actually, it's like children. It's another audience that they're kind of rediscovering, And maybe it's through cartoons like Alison Bechdel and her book Fun Home, or Marjan Satrapi and her book Persepolis, which is now a big movie. The graphic novels have reached out beyond the superhero, means you are influencing a lot of people who never thought about comics, and to create them and read them. So, yeah, I think it's just a great era we're in now, not only because you're putting out, there's histories being rediscovered, like what you're doing, but the whole field is just opening up in ways it hadn't before.
Well, Ben, thank you for coming tonight. I appreciate that. Thanks, everyone. It's great to be in the library. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.